All right.
So,
we left off in chapter 4. We remember, of course, the four main characters. The first one is the king, Ahasuerus. And what kind of king was he? Great? Bad? In between? Pretty bad, wasn't he? And really kind of a pushover. And so he didn't... He was, of course, abdicated his responsibilities as king for the most part. He just simply liked to entertain and party and that sort of thing. Wasn't a very good leader of men, all of that. So we remember, of course, primarily that he disposed of his wife Vashti because she wouldn't be paraded in front of the drunken men that he wanted her to. So he, of course, got rid of her and replaced her with Esther then, a young, beautiful Jewish woman who he snatched up by way of his servants, of course, along with hundreds of other young women, and forced them into his bed simply to see who would take the place of Vashti. And Esther won, and she became queen. And, of course, she was raised by her cousin Mordecai, the third character in this story. And Mordecai was kind of laying low, you remember, not letting individuals know about his Jewish background and all of that. He taught Esther to do the same thing. But then he got into a little bit of trouble with the fourth character, Haman. And Haman was exalted to prime minister, the second in power over all of the kingdom of Persia, massive kingdom, and everybody would bow down to him except Mordecai. Mordecai refused to do that. As a result, Haman decided that he would annihilate not simply Mordecai, but all of the Jews. So we left off last week, and we were looking at how the beginning in chapter 4, of course, he mourned. He was mourning in sackcloth and all of that. Esther heard about that and sent him down some clothes so he could stop making a scene there and everything, but he wouldn't wear them. And so sent Haphak, remember, one of the king's eunuchs, to see what was really going on. And that's when he broke the news about the edict to annihilate all of the Jews. And so that came back to her. We read all of that back, her response, really, down at about verse 9. It's verse 10. It says, then Esther spoke to Haphak and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all of the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court, which without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And so, you know, she gets this news. It's terrible news. She hesitates a little bit. I don't know what we should make too much of that. We're going to find out here tonight that her hesitation didn't last very long at all, if that's what it was. She basically sends back word, and she just, you know, wants to let him know you realize what you're asking. And as we think about this, if we read up further, he at verse 7 said, Mordecai told them all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, and he might show it to Esther and explain to her. And then it says, and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And so that was a big ask, wasn't it? And when you think about everything now that is involved in that, he is asking her to do something that would be very difficult to do. How many of you, probably many of you, have seen either the movie, the movies or the series back in, I guess, the 70s or so, whatever, Mission Impossible. And that's what this was. It was basically, from an outward standpoint, physical standpoint, a mission that seemed to be pretty much impossible for her to pull off. Like, there are several things that would have to be accomplished for her to be able to save her people. And the first thing she'd have to do is break the law. And so, as she suggested to him, reminded Mordecai, he probably already knew, and no one could go into the king, into his inner court, without an invitation. And the law was, if you did, you would be put to death. And so there was a high probability that she would never even make it to stage two. Like, it was a better chance than not that she would die, that the king would have her executed. And that's just what those kings did. We have different things, archaeologists and things have discovered drawings and things that show kings in Persia sitting on their throne, and they see a man standing next to the throne with an axe. Who was he? He was the executioner. And and the king would often use him. And so that is something that they did. And then on top of all of this, he tells Mordecai, I haven't even seen him for 30 days. And so she has no idea how he is feeling towards her. And you know, he is probably with other women and that sort of thing. It's just what they did and who they were. And she could have very easily fallen out of favor with him, so far as she knows. And so it she would be risking her life. Also, he would be in all of this. In order to pull it off, she'd have to out herself as a Jew, wouldn't she? And he certainly didn't know. There's, you know, just the few people that would know in her inner circle, but her husband didn't know, and obviously Haman didn't know. But that would go out the window with this. And so that would be a very difficult thing. I mean, you just think, how would the king respond to that? He might very well think, you have deceived me for these 4 years we've been married. And could become belligerent. One thing she has discovered was his personality. He often lost control. And, you know, he had that kind of personality. He loved to party, sometimes be very excited, or sometimes be very sad and very mad, and you didn't know when he was just going to go off. And so something like that, her telling him that she's a Jew, could very well set him off. Not only that, but now in the whole thing, she would be going against Haman, who, as we said, has more power than anyone else in the kingdom except the king himself. And so what are the odds? Furthermore, she'd have to somehow convince the king to reverse an irreversible law. And we'll see as the story unfolds how they kind of get around that. But on the surface right now, that's a part of what he is asking her to do, what would have to be done for the Jews to be saved. And so Mission Impossible, it kind of sounds like it. Kind of sounds like it. And so who doesn't understand why she might at first send back and say, you do realize what you're asking me to do, don't you? And we can certainly understand that. His response then at verse 12, it says, and they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And then Mordecai told him to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. Basically, he is saying to her, listen, you're dead anyway. don't think you're going to escape. When this edict gets out there, Haman is going to make sure all of the Jews are killed, and you're one of them. So you're not going to escape. Don't think just because you're safe in the palace right now, everything's comfortable and nice, it's going to turn out well for you. He's being honest with his cousin. No, you're not going to escape this situation. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, which begins to show us the faith of Mordecai. Was Mordecai perfect? No, last week we spent time talking about both him and Esther, that they weren't perfect, but they weren't terrible either. And they were good. They doing the best they can, basically, as they're in captivity. And one thing that this reveals, Mordecai was a man of faith. Why would he be so convinced that somehow the Jews are going to survive? I mean, he doesn't have any inside information. Why does he say this to Esther? If you don't help, help is going to come. There's going to be deliverance. Why would he say that? Huh? Right. He trusted, had faith in God, and without question, like all the Jews, they're very much aware of the Abrahamic covenant. They're very much aware of the fact that the Messiah would come through his offspring, which is them. He knew God would have to intervene. The Messiah had not yet come. Somehow or another, the Jews would have to be rescued. And he had faith just based on the promises of God that somehow God was going to intervene. And we kind of see what, you know, human emotions are really about. Because this is the same man, of course, who was mourning and had sackcloth on. And so, but still, he, at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, he believed somehow God would deliver the people. And that's trusting God's word. What about us? Do we believe God's word will come through all the time? That God will always do what he says? That his word is always right? Do we trust the promises of God? He cannot lie. That's exactly right. And but we, in real life, we need to believe that. When God says you seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Do we believe that? Are you a worrier? Do you worry all the time? Are you filled with anxiety just regularly? Things happen in life that give us some pause, of course, but then we just like Mordecai, pull ourselves together and remind ourselves God is in charge. He's still on his throne. We can trust him. We can trust his word. And Mordecai did that. Clearly, he believed that. But as for Esther, if she didn't, if she just decided, okay, I'm just going to continue to conceal my Jewish background and not going to do anything about this situation. And again, from just an outward, we know, again, as we just said, God would intervene. But just from a physical aspect, if she just decided, I'm going to sit back and just whatever happens with regard to the people, then he warns her about that. Said, but you and your father's house would perish. And I have no idea why he said that or how he thought that would happen. But somehow he believed, because she wouldn't intervene on behalf of God's people, that he would punish her and her father's house. And then he makes the statement, which is one of the great statements with regard to the providence of God that we have in the Bible. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And the fact of the matter is, that's exactly what has happened. That God providentially arranged for Esther to come on the scene and to be in this position and in the kingdom to rescue his people. The whole book is about that and the providence of God. Even though the name God is never mentioned in the book. That's why there's some over the years who have thought that the book of Esther shouldn't even be in the Bible. Because God is never mentioned. And it is not an overly religious book. unless you understand a lot of this, like even when she says that, you know, at right away, well, I guess we haven't gotten to it yet, but we if we go on, it says verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go and gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. So said, you get all the Jews and fast. She goes on to say that she and her women, they would do the same thing. Now, in the Bible, what usually accompanies fasting? Prayer. But it doesn't mention anything about prayer. And that's why, you know, people say, you know, it's just, it's probably the least religious book in all the Bible. And again, God not even mentioned. But we have to believe, again, that fasting and prayer goes together. That the Jews throughout this Persian kingdom were doing some praying. And as well as Esther and certainly Mordecai. And so, you know, you kind of have to read between the lines with regard to the presence of God in this book. But there's no doubt that he is involved. And almost all the main things that are going on in the book are providential in nature. Mordecai was right. She was put in the kingdom for this very purpose, so that the Jews would be rescued. Well, we go on and read this. It says again, now you get all of the Jews and pray. And then she says, and then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. And basically from this time forward, we see Esther kind of coming alive. Her real faith begins to show itself. Her wisdom, her courage, all of that comes to the surface. Basically, not that it hasn't at all before. We've seen some good characteristics in her, of course, her humility and so on, her willingness to obey Mordecai, all of that. But she really becomes a force and shows the wisdom that she had that went a long way in helping to deliver the Jews. But this attitude right here, again, how after maybe a moment's hesitation, if that's what it was, she's now ready to go before the king. And if I perish, I perish. She's willing to put God's will and God's people before her own life. That's who Esther was. That's why we can all learn from her. We need to be like her. Do we have that attitude? If I perish, I'm going to do God's will no matter what it is. And if I perish, I perish. And in this country, as we've often said, we don't have the threat of losing our lives. So it might be a little different. We might have to say, if I lose my family, I'll lose my family. You know, whatever it is. If I'm fired from my job, I'm fired from my job. You know, you just fill in the blank. The sacrifice might be a little bit different, but do you have that kind of sacrificial attitude? I lose friends, then so be it. I lose friends. If I perish, I perish. That should be the attitude that we all have. God comes first. I'm going to seek God first in His kingdom, His righteousness, and I'm going to trust that He'll take care of me. And if not, if you know, it's kind of like the attitude that she had, kind of like the three friends of Daniel, isn't it? Remember what they said? Were they going to quit? Were they worried about being burned up in the fire? No. And even if they did, so be it. It's the will of God, and that's the attitude that we should have. We go through life. We're going to put Him first, let our light shine, stand up for Christ, preach the gospel, and whatever the consequences are, then so be it. We're going to do what's right. And that's Esther. Let's be like Esther. And so that's where she is at this time. If I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Then we get into chapter 5. And so in chapter 5, then they've done the fasting, all of that. It says, and on the third day, that's in reference to the fasting. They've all fasted for 3 days, all of that, haven't eaten. And on the third day, Esther puts on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on the royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. This was a massive, massive room. Pillars, they we're told that were 65 feet tall. And marble floors, just a magnificent place. And the king in there, he didn't want to be bothered. No one can come in there unless he gave them the okay. And so just, you know, particularly not only right there in that palace area, but then in the throne room itself, he was isolated from everything. And if you walk in there, you'd be in trouble if you weren't invited. He doesn't want to be caught by surprise or anything. And here's Esther. Can you imagine how she felt? You know, she gets ready for it. She puts on her royal clothes and she heads to the place where she knows she's breaking the law, basically. And so what was she thinking? How, when he raises his head and sees me, what's going to happen? That's the moment of truth right here, really, at verse 1. She put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters. In other words, she is now in his sight. He looks up and sees her. He's either going to be real mad that she had the nerve to come into his presence, or he's going to lift up the golden scepter. And not only her fate, but the fate of Israel is being decided right now. And again, we know the story, so we know it goes deeper than that. But for, act like you don't know the story, and you're just her. And you're taking this great risk to save the people of God. Fortunately, we don't have to wait too long to find out what happens. You know, this, can you imagine, I mean, like, if this was a movie you have never seen, it's why people always say Esther would be a great movie, particularly if you hadn't read the story in the Bible, like all kind of drama that's behind it. And this would be, you know, the one of the most dramatic scenes in the movie. And, but there she is now. And then, but verse 2 says, and when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So you can imagine how relieved she was when that happened. She had not fallen out of favor with him. And so he sees her. He's immediately touched, and lifts up the golden scepter. And says, what is it? And the king said to her, what is it, Queen Esther? And you notice now, when she's, you know, up to a certain point, now it's almost always, it's Queen Esther. She's the queen. And so, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you even to half of my kingdom. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come together to a feast that I have prepared for the king. And then the king said, bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And so, you know, it's kind of anticlimactic right at this moment. She's in position right now. He's like, what do you want? I'll give you half the kingdom. And you kind of anticipate her requesting what it is that she wants. But now, in her wisdom, she begins to kind of, basically, she plays the king like a fiddle. She really gets it to the point where she's sure that he is going to respond the way she wants and the way that is needed and necessary. So she could have just told him right there on the spot, but somehow she sensed this is not the time. And she kind of has a game plan that involves not only them, but Haman. Because remember, she's past the critical point with regard to her own life. But there's still the bigger situation that needs to be resolved. And that is this edict that has come against the Jews. And that's the main goal. So she has no counseling or anything like that. She comes up with this plan herself. I'm going to invite them to a feast. And he immediately agrees and orders them to call Haman. And so they go to this feast. And it says at verse 5, the king said, or verse 6, and as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? And it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom, it should be fulfilled." Well, great. He's been drinking, and you know he's a pushover. And so this is the time, we would think, for her to really explain the situation, how the edict went out and all of that. Remember, she'd have to reveal that she's a Jew. Then Esther answered, "My wish in my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." So she arranges for another feast. Now, we're told here when it says at the beginning of verse 7, "My wish in my request," and then the ESV says "is." And I think some of your translations might say "this is" or something like that. But that's not in the original Hebrew text. And so it really is just "my wish in my request." And then it gets right into "if I have found favor." And most believe there's a pause there. Kind of a dramatic pause that would raise the curiosity of the king. And it's kind of, this is one of these situations that it's hard to, like, if, you know, if someone sends you a letter or something, you can read the letter, but you really can't get the sense of the emotion that the person had when they were writing the letter. You just can't. Only way you can do that is in a face-to-face situation. So we're reading this, but because of the certain tense of the Hebrew that I know nothing about, but Hebrew scholars will affirm that this was a very dramatic, the way she set it up was very dramatic. And you can't get the full sense just reading it. But if you were in that room, you know that she paused just at the right time, got the curiosity of the king up, so that he would agree to, you know, he'd be waiting. So, okay, we'll come back for a feast tomorrow. And he would be anticipating that. And she's always very humble about the whole thing. Always on the passive side. But she knows exactly what she's doing. And so he agrees. He agrees to come back the next day. Now, you know, that's not too surprising. What do we know about Xerxes? What does he like to do? He like to drink and party and all that. That's what's going on in these things as well. And so, you know, convincing him, "Oh, let's put it off one more day. We'll have another feast, more drinking." And, you know, yeah, he wouldn't have to twist his arm too much. But there's just, you know, he's curious. You know, what is it? You know, what brought you to appear? He knew the first time he saw her in this place where she wasn't supposed to be, that there had to be something on her mind, because she was risking, I mean, he knew she was risking your life to do this. And he just loved her, was attracted to her, and so lifted up that golden scepter. So he still wants to know, what is it that you really want? But she arranged it so that he would wait till the next day. to get the answer. And so at verse 9 then, it says, and Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. Now, why do you think he was joyful and glad of heart? Huh? Right. I mean, this was special. When's the last time you've been invited to the White House? Sit down with the president and the first lady. You know, I mean, and nobody but you. I'm not talking about a group meeting here. I'm not talking about a basketball team just won the championship and they all go there to the White House. No. You just you. You, the president, and the first lady. Like, he's thinking, I'm special. Boy, that king loves me. It's great. And so he's full of joy. And glad of heart, it says. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Like, really? How arrogant do you have to be? And, I mean, you have all this going for it. Why do you care about one man here? You know, this whole thing got started because everybody was bound to him but one man. And he, for that, he's willing to annihilate a whole race of people. And now he just comes. He has an audience with the king and her queen. And he's moved by that. But he happens to go by Mordecai again, and he doesn't even stand up. Like, Mordecai is even getting more defiant. He doesn't even stand up. He doesn't even recognize him at all. And so he's filled with wrath, it says. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and he brought his friends and his wife, Zeres. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches. This is what prideful people do. Like, he's a little bit, his pride's wounded a little bit because of this one man. So he gets to his house, his wife and his friends here, who are really his advisors. And they're not much friends anyway. But they're his advisors. And the first thing he does is begin to out loud recount all, you know, all the riches he has and the number of his sons. I think he has 10 sons. All the promotions with which the king had honored him and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. What about all of that? Did they not know? They knew all of that already, didn't they? But he's making himself feel good to think about all this that he has. But he said, well, then even in verse 12, he says, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I'm invited by her together with the king. He has no idea, does he? He thinks this is a great and wonderful thing. And she's just setting him up. But it says, yet all of this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. And then his wife, Zeres, and all of his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made. And in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. And these gallows, that's like when you think about that and you think about being hung on them, like what comes to your mind? You know, what we're used to is, you know, noose around the neck, that sort of, that's not what that's talking about at all. They would be in the Persian Empire, their way of punishing, you would be impaled on these. And high up, so everybody would walk by and see your body up on this stake-like situation. And so that's what he's planning. And why? Why was that necessary? I mean, if he would have just let that be, what would have happened anyway, according to his plan? He was going to be executed with all the other Jews anyway. And so, you know, why even go through all of this?
He's trying to make a point.
Right, right.
Trying to make a point that, hey, this singled this guy out and saying, hey.
Yeah.
This is how beautiful this guy is and how much pride he has. He's trying to make a point.
Right.
This one Mordecai.
Yeah, that's all he's really trying to do. And the problem is now he's building his own the thing that he's going to die upon. And so now, so, but that's what happens when you're prideful and full of vengeance and all of that. So, it goes up, this idea pleased Haman and he had the gallows made. All right. So that's the end of chapter 5. And then again, we get into chapter 6. We don't have much time. The bell's going to ring. But on chapter 6, we find, remember, what did Haman do way back in chapter 2? The end of chapter 2? Huh? Oh, no, Mordecai, I'm sorry. I keep calling these guys different names. Right. So Mordecai, talking about Mordecai, in chapter 2, Mordecai basically saved the king's life by revealing the plot against him. But nothing happened. Nothing came about that, which is kind of surprising. And now it's surprising even to the king. Now we're going to find the king is you know, wondering, what happened with that? What do we do for that guy? And the answer is nothing. Well, he didn't like that at all. And so we'll find out next week when we get into chapter 6, then he's going to do something for him. And Haman's not going to like it. So we'll talk about that next week.